The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. President Obama released his budget this week, a 10-year, $4 trillion spending blueprint, including more than $1 trillion in proposed taxes over the next decade. The president called it an end to mindless austerity, while Republicans on Capitol Hill called it unacceptable, and that the president's plan would move the country in the wrong direction. But on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, members of Congress and the president's team said they saw room for compromise in two areas, corporate tax reform and infrastructure spending. Meanwhile, the House this week voted once again to fully repeal the Affordable Care Act, and members are preparing for a vote next week that will make a huge political statement whether to jumpstart the controversial Keystone Pipeline project already approved by the U.S. Senate. This hour in The Exchange, political junkie Ken Rudin helps us sort through these and other political stories. Each month, Ken joins us with his veteran observer's eye on the political news of the nation. Let's hear from you, too. Your questions and comments for Ken are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken Rudin, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, before we dive into all the substance of our show, and there's a lot to talk about, do you have a trivia question for us, Ken?
Well, I do. I noticed in the Union Leader, because I read that every morning, I noticed in the Union Leader that among the names of the Republicans who are bandied about as potential 2016 presidential hopefuls is somebody by the name of Kelly Ayotte. Now, she is, as you well know, a senator from New Hampshire whose term also ends in 2016. So the question is whether she could run for both vice president and or president and senator at the same time. Apparently, there's nothing in New Hampshire law that says forbids her from doing that, according to Bill Gardner, the Secretary of State. So with that very, very long intro, we all know that Joe Biden in 2008 was a senator seeking reelection, and he also ran for vice president, and he was elected to both. So there's been a precedent for that. So before Joe Biden, who was the last senator who was on the ballot for both either president or vice president and reelection to the Senate?
So say it again, Ken, okay?
I have no idea what I just said. But if I did understand the question, before Joe Biden, who was the last senator who was on the ballot for either president or vice president and reelection to a Senate office at the same time?
Okay. Well, Exchange listeners, there's our trivia question. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us your answer by email, exchange@nhpr.org. No Googling the answer. That kind of goes against the spirit of a trivia challenge. So we're on the honor system here. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, if you think you know the answer to Ken's trivia question. So, Ken, the budget, President Obama presented it this week. Republicans had their response. Let's jump into that. Just remind us how this unfolds, Ken. It's not like the president releases his budget and everyone says, sounds great, let's do this.
Well, I think instead of, and I don't think the exact words are, "Let's, it's great, let's do this." I think the words you usually hear are, dead on arrival. And of course, if the President Obama, as he did in the State of the Union, you know, offered a tremendous laundry list of great positions. I mean, basically, it was a laundry list of what the Democratic Party stands for, and we'll see how Congress can respond to it. But ultimately, for all the things that he's proposing, free community college and early education programs and affordable child care and things like that, veterans counseling. He pays for it by raising the taxes on the wealthy and raising corporate taxes, and that is a non-starter for many, many Republicans. And so the question is, who is the president really talking to? Is he really talking to the Republicans in Congress, or is he talking to the American people saying, look, you know, this makes sense, and come join with me in this crusade?
Well, let's hear a little bit of what the president said.
Friends, colleagues, countrymen, and especially the people of Ohio's 8th Congressional.
And that was a cut of John Boehner, not President Obama. So we'll look for that cut of President Obama in his budget address, laying out some of the priorities that you mentioned, Ken, from community college to infrastructure spending and so forth. Let's hear the president.
This week, I will send a budget to Congress that will help working families' paychecks go farther by treating things like paid leave and child care like the economic priorities that they are. We'll offer Americans of every age the chance to upgrade their skills so they can earn higher wages, with plans like making 2 years of community college free for every responsible student. And we'll keep building the world's most attractive economy for high-wage jobs, with new investments in research, infrastructure, manufacturing, and expanded access to faster internet and new markets.
So again, there's the president presenting his budget. He called it, as I said, Ken, an end to, this is his term, mindless austerity. What's he talking about there, mindless austerity?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, it was interesting when you said that you were hearing the president, and then we heard John Boehner's voice. Do you know, if John Boehner was president, he would be the second person of color in a row to become president after Barack Obama?
That was a joke that the president himself made at one point, given John Boehner's propensity for tanning. But go ahead. Yeah.
I thought I made that joke up. I'm sorry. Okay, well, here it is. Because the two parties failed to come up to an agreement on the budget a few years ago, there was a thing called sequestration. And basically, that it was implemented in 2013, and that means that there are automatic budget cuts on domestic policies, on military policies, automatic without Congress having to do anything. And then it basically seriously cuts into many of these programs. And it's because the two parties couldn't come to an agreement, we have these sequester. Both the Republicans and the White House just, you know, they hate this sequester. It's basically mindless cutting because there's really no say in the matter. So if we're talking about some possibility of some kind of a deal worked out by Democrats and Republicans, by the White House and the congressional Republicans, it could be over this automatic cuts and sequester. And that's the stuff that President Obama and the Republicans are just so unhappy with.
Well, and we've got some sound of the Republican response to this speech. But first, Ken, a lot of response to your trivia question. Again, before Joe Biden, who was the last U.S. senator to run for president and his or her Senate seat?
Well, president
at the same
or
time.
Vice president.
President or
vice president and re-election to the Senate.
Well, and here's Jack in Candia. He says, Bob Dole?
Well, Bob Dole actually was, when he ran for, when he was not the nominee, the answer is not Bob Dole. Bob Dole, of course, was a senator for a long time when he made three bids for the presidency, but he never ran for both offices at the same time, was not on the ballot. Let me just rephrase something about the question. They were on the ballot at the same time for president or vice president and the Senate. They were on the ballot at the same time.
Okay.
So that's what Joe Biden was in 2008. Who was the last senator before Joe Biden?
Okay, well, here's another response. This is from Steve. He says, how about LBJ?
LBJ, now this is interesting. This is called the LBJ law because the Texas legislature in 1959, as you well remember, changed the law that allowed him to run for both. And so this has been called the LBJ law ever since. He wanted to be president. Of course, he was John F. Kennedy's vice president and did run for the Senate and vice president in the same year in 1960. LBJ is a good guess, but he's not the most recent to do that.
All right. Well, thanks to both of those folks. Let's go to our callers, see if they've got the answer. Fred is in Salem. Hi, Fred. Go ahead. You're on the exchange with political junkie Ken Rudin.
Hi. Thanks. I think it's John Kerry from Massachusetts.
Ah, is that possible?
John Kerry was the presidential nominee in 2004, but his Senate seat was not up in 2004. It was up in actually 2002. 2002, so he wasn't up for re-election in 2004.
Okay, so he didn't have that tricky question.
He did not have to run
what
for
seat
both
do you
year,
really
no.
want? Okay, well, thanks for chiming in, Fred. And how about Patrick in Hampton? Go ahead, Patrick. You're on the exchange.
I thought it was Mondale.
Mondale. Walter Mondale. How about that, Ken?
Well, Walter Mondale was elected vice president in 1976, but his Senate seat was up in 1974. So he did not have, he was not on the ballot for both jobs in 76.
And it varies state by state, right, Ken? I mean, in some states you can do this. In other states they say, no, you got to pick.
Exactly. And that's the thing that's upsetting both Rand Paul and Marco Rubio. Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, Marco Rubio, the Republican senator from Florida, both are up. Both Senate seats are up in 2016, and both are seriously considering a run for president. Neither state allows you to run for both, and they're going to have to make a decision.
Oh, that's tricky. All right. Well, here's another email guest that came in. This is from BJ, who says Joe Lieberman.
BJ is the correct answer. Joe Lieberman in the year 2000 was, of course, reelected to his Senate seat in Connecticut. And, of course, he was Al Gore's part of that unsuccessful presidential ticket, running for vice president with Al Gore. So Joe Lieberman is the correct answer.
Well, and so this comes up every so often. It's kind of tricky politically, though, right? I mean, if you do decide to run for both at the same time, people say, well, what do you care more about? Or if I remember when it happened with Joe Lieberman, people said, is that a statement on your running mate? You don't think you're going to win, so you're holding on to your Senate seat just in case.
Well, not only that, I mean, sometimes if it's the case with Joe Lieberman, I think when Lieberman was running for vice president and the Senate, if he was elected vice president and he'd have to give up a Senate seat, there was a Republican governor of Connecticut, and the Republican would have chosen his successor. So a lot of people were upset with Lieberman with the fact for not choosing because, of course, if had he been elected vice president, the Democrats would have lost a Senate seat. Now, it's happened in the House several times as well. Paul Ryan was the Republican nominee for vice president in 2012, and he ran for reelection to his House seat. Of course, the trivia question was talking about the last senator, but it's happened in the House as well.
Well, great job on the trivia question exchange.
And one
listeners.
More, actually.
Yeah.
Another example, Lloyd Benson in 1988 was Michael Dukakis' running mate. He was also running for reelection to the Senate from Texas in 88. He won the Senate seat, but not the vice presidency.
How do you think Rand Paul is going to sort this out?
Rand Paul is trying to work around. He's been talking about somehow working with the state legislature to change the rules, but it's a Democratic state legislature, and they're not particular fans of Rand Paul. It's a good question. We don't know how it's going to happen. Apparently, the word I'm hearing on Marco Rubio is that obviously he's going to have to decide how strong Jeb Bush's candidacy is because they probably steal from the same kind of votes and support in Florida. But Rubio seems to be clearly going to have to decide to give up his Senate seat. That's the expectation. Rand Paul still thinks he can run for both. We don't know how that's going to happen yet.
All right. Well, Exchange listeners, thanks for all the activity on the trivia question. It's fun. And coming up, we'll talk about the Republican response to President Obama's budget. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today in The Exchange, it's our monthly check-in with political junkie Ken Rudin. Ken joins us once a month to talk about some of the big national political headlines. We're catching up on some of that today, including President Obama's budget, which we talked about a moment ago, and the Republican response to that budget. Let's hear now from Representative Tom Price. He's a Republican from Georgia. He's chair of the House Budget Committee.
The president's words would be good news if, in fact, his policies had worked in the past. Remember, these are the same policies that have got us the slowest recovery since the economic downturn, slowest recovery ever. His budget never balances. It spends more, taxes more, borrows more. And every single one of those dollars that is used for taxing and borrowing is a dollar that can't be used to buy a home, to buy a car, to pay your rent, to pay your mortgage, to send a kid to school. So this is just moving in the wrong direction.
So, Ken Rudin, how about that? You know, words like wrong direction, dead on arrival, makes you wonder, why does President Obama bother doing this? Or is this budget really a budget document or more a political document?
Well, the answer is yes, of course. I mean, ultimately, the president does feel that there are some things that he and the Republicans in Congress can work together on. Of course, trade authority is one of the things. Part of that $4 trillion budget is a proposal to spend $478 billion for 6 years to improve roads, bridges, mass transit, infrastructure like that. And the Republicans seem to be on the same page as that. But as Tom Price said, I mean, what Tom Price said has basically been the Republican argument against the Obama budget from day one, from 2009, basically that we're not going to, whatever the president wants to do, it's not going to be on the backs of the so-called wealthy. I mean, the Republicans will not call them wealthy. They'll call them, you know, businessmen and things like that. But Obama's really addressing, is really talking to the larger American public who sees that the economy does seem to be improving, as he noted during the State of the Union address. Unemployment is down to 5.6%, which is the lowest of his presidency. Gas prices are down all around the country, and that's really rewarding for the American people. So I think the American people, are starting to think that their economy, the economy is improving, their economic lives are improving, and so with that in mind, President Obama, also with rising popularity numbers, job approval numbers, feels he has the American people on his side. But again, when it comes to negotiating with the Republican Congress, the words higher taxes on the wealthy is just a non-starter.
Yeah, so the president's cabinet is on Capitol Hill this week, now that the budget's been released, making the case before the various committees. Again, is this a political exercise, or does anything of substance come out of this?
Well, I think, a lot of it is, and people say that maybe what he's doing is writing Hillary Clinton's platform for 2016, and there is something to be said about that. This is really about the Democratic philosophy and Democratic priorities, about, you know, child care and community college and things like that, and something that President Obama has been talking about for the longest time. So, yes, it is, in some sense, a political document. But at the same time, he'd love to get something done. And I think the Republicans said, as Mitch McConnell and John Boehner said after 2014 elections, they say, look, it's one thing for us to be in the minority and start just attacking and opposing everything President Obama suggests. But at the same time, now that we control Congress, we have to offer a blueprint on our own. We have to show we can govern. So I think it may be in the Republicans' best interest, as well as the White House's, to work out some kind of a deal. But again, if we're talking about higher taxes, that's not going to happen.
So infrastructure spending, corporate tax reform, some areas that a lot of people said there might be some room for compromise. I want to ask you about another area, Ken, where there doesn't seem to be room for compromise, and this is the Keystone Pipeline. Now, just remind us, the Senate finally passed this after Harry Reid, the former head of the Senate, kept blocking it. He didn't want it to get to the president's desk. So now what has the Senate done with this? And the House is getting ready to vote on Keystone, I think, next week.
Right. That's what it looks like. I mean, the thing that you mentioned something, and it's worth reminding that President Obama has not had to use his veto for most of his presidency, because whatever the Republican House would pass and send up to the Senate, Harry Reid would often block it. Harry Reid would often refuse to allow votes. He wouldn't allow Republican amendments. And even in the election, when the Senate voted on Keystone Pipeline last year, when the Democrats were in charge, it only went down by one vote. So you knew that time was on the side of the Republicans with Keystone. The president argues, and he says that the reason I will veto a Keystone Pipeline bill that comes to my desk is because it infringes on the authority of the president to make that decision. But having said that, one, he's under tremendous pressure from environmentalists and the environmentalist community around the country, that Keystone Pipeline could be a disaster in the making. It could hurt the environment. It can hurt clean water, you know, water and air quality and things like that. But he's going to still have to make a decision. The president has still never said, I'm against this pipeline. As a matter of fact, there was a pipeline he approved from Western Canada to go through the U.S. into the Gulf, into the Gulf in Louisiana. He approved that in 2009. So it's not that oil is not coming from Canada through the U.S., but this one looks especially just something that the environmental community says, this is just one step too far. And he still hasn't made a decision. He may veto it because he'll make the argument that it's against his, you know, it infringes on his authority. But both sides are still waiting for the president to make a decision one way or the other how he feels about it, and he's not done that.
Well, Speaker John Boehner responded to Obama's threat to veto the Keystone Pipeline. Let's hear what he said.
And let's be clear about this. A Keystone Pipeline veto would send the signal that this president has no interest in listening to the American people. Vetoing an overwhelmingly popular bill would be a clear indication that he doesn't care about the American people's priorities. It would be equivalent of calling the American people stupid.
Again, there's John Boehner speaking on CBS about Obama's threat to veto the Keystone Pipeline. It's interesting to hear you say, Ken, that the president has approved other big pipelines, but not this one. It almost seems like this one has special political significance.
Well, you know something, the key word in that sentence, Laura, is political, because it seems like the environmental community did not make a big fuss in 2009 over that pipeline. They are making a big fuss over this one. But Speaker Boehner is correct. This is a very popular bill. It seems to be overwhelmingly surpassed overwhelming support in both the Senate, which passed it last week, and the House, as you say, which is likely to take it up next week. But maybe Obama can make the argument that, one, we don't have to rush into it, although it's taken him 6 years to make a decision on this, and two, with gas prices down so much that maybe he can make the case that, well, you know, if this is supposed to help with gas prices, help with jobs, well, maybe this is not needed at this time. But ultimately, you know, for when Obama goes to the country and says, look, the American people are in favor of immigration overhaul, they are in favor of raising the minimum wage, and he's correct on that, Boehner is just as correct in saying the American people are in favor of this pipeline.
Well, from pipeline politics to foreign policy, Ken, I did want to ask you about another headline.
That is the most amazing transition I've ever heard you make, ever.
I try. By the way, the number for you to join us, our conversation with Ken Rudin, our monthly check-in on some of the big national political headlines is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us with your take on some of the political headlines that caught your attention over these past few weeks. We're covering some of them, including the president's budget, the Republican response, the Keystone Pipeline. I want to turn now, though, Ken, to what some have called BBgate. This has to do with the speech by Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel. He was invited by Congress to come speak. I think John Boehner extended the invitation. Now, just remind us why this is so fraught. I mean, prime ministers come and speak before Congress all the time.
Well, that's true, and it's often that's Congress who invites them, but several things happened in this case. First of all, a little background. Congress is clearly nervous about any negotiations with Iran about its nuclear capabilities, and that's a negotiation that's going on right now. Congress is nervous about it. Even Democrats are nervous about it. They feel that Tehran will not honor its request, honor the things that they signed, and so there's a lot of nervousness about that. That's undeniable. But when the invitation to Benjamin Netanyahu was made by the Speaker, John Boehner, without any consultation to the White House at all, now that seemed to be a little bit of maybe Boehner peek at the president, maybe a little sticking it to the White House, because I think a lot of people, a lot of Republicans in Congress feel that Obama stuck it to them when he said, look, I'm going to use my executive action. I'm going to go beyond Congress on immigration, on Cuba policy, on climate change. So I mean, I'm not a psychologist, clearly. And so, you know, I'm not saying that Boehner did that just to get back at the president because the president dissed Congress on these things. But there's a clear disagreement. There's a clear disagreement between Boehner's approach to these Iranian sanctions, Congress's approach, and the White House's. And why not pick Netanyahu? Because Netanyahu and Obama clearly don't get along either. But by doing that, they say it's a breach of protocol, but it really is. It's not that Congress has no say in foreign policy. Look, during the Vietnam War, Congress would often vote against funding, and it would irk President Ford and President Nixon. Congress voted against aid to the Contras, which of course didn't make President Reagan happy. So it's not that Congress doesn't get involved in foreign policy, but it almost seemed like a deliberate snub taking somebody who's clearly at odds with the president, and Netanyahu and the president are at odds over Israeli settlements, over the desire by Obama that any kind of negotiations in the Middle East should start with the 1967 borders, which is anathema to Netanyahu and most of Israel. But, I mean, picking somebody who deliberately has a battle and a conflict with the president just seemed a little bit over the top. And I think certainly a lot of people in Israel feel that way, and more members of Congress are feeling that way as well, especially Democrats.
I have another question for you about this, Ken, too, but I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We're sitting down with Ken Rudin, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And here's an email that came in from Liz in Londonderry on this. She says, putting aside the slap to Obama of the invitation by the speaker and the impropriety of the acceptance, Liz says, I understand there has been a drawdown of BB politics and that Israeli Ambassador Dermer is now taking the spot to address Congress. Have you heard that, Ken, that the ambassador is now going to do it instead of the prime minister? That would be obviously less politically exciting, if I could put it that way.
No, I have not heard that. That is very interesting. But here's the thing. The Israeli ambassador to the U.S., as you mentioned, Mr. Dermer, used to be a top Republican aide on Capitol Hill. So he was a longtime Republican strategist. A lot of people saying that it was Dermer, basically, who went to Boehner and said, you know, why don't you have this invitation?
Oh,
because
that's interesting.
Netanyahu really – I mean, look, Netanyahu is clearly nervous about Iranian intentions in the region, and they're nervous about Iranian nuclear capability. So that's legitimate. But Dermer is apparently – the fact that he comes from the Republicans and now has since become the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., a lot of people are pointing the finger at him and saying, well, he's responsible and he's behind these whole shenanigans. But it's kind of interesting that Dermer may be mentioned. I'm not convinced, though, that Netanyahu will speak to Congress. There's tremendous pressure on him not to do that. It's not helping his reelection campaign, which is in March. A lot of people feel that a lot of the Obama administration, some people there say that, okay, let's invite him, but let's do it after the election. He's kind of gotten himself in a little flap, a further flap, not only with the president, which has always been personal, but with foreign policy and vis-a-vis the U.S. and Israel, and that's not what Netanyahu or Boehner really wanted to accomplish.
Well, how do Democrats decide whether to attend this Netanyahu speech? I've read that some, you know, want to show their strong support for Israel, but they also don't want to upset the White House.
Well, that's interesting, too, because obviously President Obama made it clear that he is not going to meet with Netanyahu when he's in the country. Neither will Joe Biden. Biden has said that he's not sure if he's going to attend the joint session of Congress when Netanyahu speaks. Now, other Democrats have said that they may come, they may not come. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic minority leader in the House, says she may come. But there are a lot of members of Democrats, members of Congress, who are hearing signals from the White House saying that, well, maybe boycotting the speech or forgetting to show up may be one way of expressing their disapproval.
All right. Well, one more story from Capitol Hill that I did want to get to with you, Ken, and that's the nomination of a new attorney general, Loretta Lynch. One of the things that came up in her nomination hearing this week was less about who she was and what she wanted to do and more about who she wasn't. Let's hear the nominee, Loretta Lynch, responding to questions from Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas.
When the attorney general refers to himself as the president's wingman, suggesting that he does not exercise independent legal judgment as the chief law enforcement officer for the country. You wouldn't consider yourself to be a political arm of the White House as Attorney General, would you?
No, Senator, that would be a totally inappropriate view of the position of Attorney General.
You'd be willing to tell your friends no if in your judgment the law required that.
Sir, I think that I have to be willing to tell not just my friends and acquaintances, but colleagues, no, if the law requires it.
Again, that's Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch at her confirmation hearing responding to questions from Republican Senator John Cornyn. What do you make of that, Ken? All that attention to who you aren't.
Laura, you missed the best quote of that exchange, because later on, Cornyn says, you're not Eric Holder, are you? And Loretta Lynch said, no, I am not. And that's the real key, because if you listen to the Senate committee confirmation hearings for Loretta Lynch, all you heard about was Republican dislike of Eric Holder, the current attorney general, that he's too partisan, he's too close to the president. Now, he's not as close as John Kennedy's attorney general, who happened to be his brother, Robert Kennedy. But, I mean, Holder and Obama are very, very close socially. They vacation together. They've been longtime allies. Loretta Lynch made the case, as most attorney generals do, that they are going to express and they're going to maintain complete independence. But if the issue was, do we reconfirm Eric Holder as attorney general, that would get rejected by the Senate overwhelmingly. But everything I've seen and heard about Loretta Lynch, I'm watching her Senate confirmation hearings in action. She seems to be eminently qualified, a no-nonsense prosecutor, and is likely to be confirmed overwhelmingly. There may be three or four Republicans who have said no, but that's all I've seen. And there are a lot of issues that surprisingly didn't come up in the confirmation hearings. Mostly it was about Eric Holder, but less about relationships between local communities and their police departments, which is an arm of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. And, you know, race relations, as we've seen with Ferguson, with Staten Island, with all these issues coming up, that is something that Eric Holder really, really seriously tried to get involved with, tried to make a case that the government needs responsible to jurisdiction over. And that didn't come up, which is surprising to me because, again, race relations, we keep thinking that Obama's election changed things. And as we learned, not much has changed in the last 8 years.
So that's interesting. So most of the hearing focused on, again, disappointment with Eric Holder.
With Eric Holder, right.
Yeah, not this idea of, you know, race relations on police forces. What about immigration, Ken? From what I understand, that was discussed a little bit in these nomination hearings.
Yes, and I mean that's of course one of the issues that is really separating the White House from Congress, and it's surprising because even though in 2013 the Senate overwhelmingly passed an immigration overhaul, the House under John Boehner throughout 2014 kept saying, "Oh yeah, we're going to get to it, we're going to get to it, we're going to get to it," and ultimately they didn't. So that's what led to the White House and the president talking about his executive authority to implement immigration policy on his own. Eric Holder seriously and strongly backed the president on that. And I think Loretta Lynch has also said that she believes that President Obama's actions, executive action on immigration, is constitutional. But again, it didn't sound like more of a personal belief. It sounded like more of her reading of the Constitution.
All right. Coming up, we'll turn to presidential primary politics. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's Political Junkie time today in The Exchange, where once a month we talk national politics with political junkie Ken Rudin. And Ken, I want to turn to the biggest news in presidential politics recently, a past nominee saying he won't give it another go. Let's listen.
After putting considerable thought into making another run for president, I've decided it's best to give other leaders in the party the opportunity to become our next nominee. I believe that one of our next generation of Republican leaders, one who may not be as well known as I am today, one who has not yet taken their message across the country, one who's just getting started, may well emerge as being better able to defeat the Democrat nominee. In fact, I expect and hope that to be the case.
And of course, that's former nominee and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney announcing he's dropping out. Ken Rudin, were you surprised by that?
No, I wasn't. Actually, I never thought he was going to run. There was a feeling, a wide feeling in the Republican Party that he had his opportunity in 2012 as a nominee. Of course, he also ran in 2008. But in 2012, there was like nearly a double-digit unemployment rate. Obama's numbers were not strong. And from the beginning, Mitt Romney made all these mistakes. A lot of them were unforced errors when he talked about self-deportation for people here illegally. He talked about the 47% of the country who feel that they are, you know, they rely on, they deserve government assistance. And, you know, he was the nominee, and yet he was the front runner from the beginning. He had all the money. He had all the establishment support. But he lost Iowa to Rick Santorum. He lost South Carolina to Newt Gingrich. Whenever there was a new candidate announcing in 2011, when Rick Perry would announce, suddenly he became the front runner. When Herman Cain announced, Herman Cain became the front runner. There was always the feeling that Romney, while the ostensible front runner, was never going to be that strong of a nominee. So I don't think Romney was really seriously thinking about 2016. He wanted more time to think about it. But when Jeb Bush made his announcement that he had this committee to perhaps prepare him for the nomination, it accelerated everybody's schedules, including Mitt Romney. And so Mitt Romney called around to a lot of his former financial people, angels, from 2012. And they said, look, your time has come and gone. You had the opportunity. You blew it, in a sense, and we're not backing you. And so Mitt Romney said, okay, I'm not running.
Wow. Well, again, Ken Rudin is here, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. He joins us once a month here on The Exchange, and you can join us, too. We're going to spend the last few minutes of our program with Ken talking about presidential politics. We're seeing a lot of presidential hopefuls here in the Granite State, of course. Join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email that came in from Malcolm Ken. He says, how will the Republican candidates in next year's Iowa caucuses rebrand themselves when they leave a very conservative corn/ethanol subsidy dependent state and head to purple New Hampshire with the lowest church attendance in the nation and where independents can vote in the Republican primary? And Malcolm, it's a great point just describing the huge differences between the Republican primary here in New Hampshire and the Republican caucus in Iowa. Go ahead, Ken.
Well, that's a great question, but if you look at the history, that is not unusual. I mean, I could go back and back into history and talk about many instances. 1988, Bob Dole wins in Iowa. George H.W. Bush wins in New Hampshire. In 2000, Bush Jr. wins in Iowa. John McCain wins in New Hampshire. In 2012, Rick Santorum wins in Iowa. Mitt Romney wins in New Hampshire. So a lot of things. I mean, in 2008, Mike Huckabee wins in Iowa. John McCain wins in New Hampshire. Very often we've seen that the winners in Iowa, whoever wins in Iowa, does not go on to a great reception in New Hampshire. But that doesn't end the battle for the nomination. I don't think, given the fact that the Republican Party is not only conservative, but far more conservative than it was during when Bush was president, the Republican candidates don't feel any need to moderate their positions when they come into New Hampshire, because even if they lose New Hampshire, coming up is South Carolina, which is very conservative, very pro-military, very pro-evangelical. So even if they lose in New Hampshire, they can go on with their battle for the nomination. So it's a very strange bunch of hoops that Republicans have to jump through. I mean, Democrats have to do it as well. But for more, I mean, and of course, we've seen differences with Iowa and New Hampshire in the Democrats, too. Just look at 2008. Barack Obama wins Iowa and Hillary Clinton wins New Hampshire. But there's more of an ideological battle going on in the Republican Party. And for all the lessons the Republicans say they learned from 2012, that they turned off women, they turned off minorities, they turned off Latinos, they turned off centrists, there doesn't seem to be any feeling, except for people like maybe perhaps Jeb Bush, that they don't have to run far to the right to get the nomination. Bush's feelings seem to be that I'm going to be who I am. I'm not going to change because of pressure from the conservatives. And, you know, good luck with that. It's still a conservative party, and we'll see if those tactics work.
Well, some people in New Hampshire, of course, feel that Iowa doesn't really have an election, right, Ken? It's just a caucus where people get together on a cold night in some high school gym and talk about who they want. It's not like people going to the polls and casting ballots in large numbers.
And of course, in a primary, you go behind in a voting booth and you vote in the privacy of the voting booth. In the caucus, it's a several-hour process when a bunch of people are in either a living room or a church or a school or something like that, and they talk about whom they support, and it's out in the open. And the the percentage of people who participate in the caucus is far less than the people who do in the primary. And, of course, a lot of people feel that the Iowa caucuses are so, you know, overrated, and what they do is it pushes the Republican Party so far to the right that it doesn't recover in time for November, and there's some legitimacy to that complaint.
Well, and of course, being here in New Hampshire, I don't want to spend too much time on Iowa, but there was a conservative gathering in Iowa recently, a couple weeks back. A lot of presidential hopefuls were there. Who was there, Ken? And just as important, who wasn't there?
Well, I think both questions are very important to talk about. First of all, who was there? Scott Walker is the governor of Wisconsin who just was reelected last year. He's had three elections in the past 4 years because in addition to his 2010 and 2014 elections, he had a recall election that he had to win. But he's very conservative, has a very strong conservative message, and he also is the kind of guy who, because of the recall election, shows that he can stand up to labor, he can stand up to the unions, he can stand up to the public service employees, which is a very good thing to say to Republican audiences. And Walker's speech seemed to go over very, very well at this Iowa Freedom Summit a few weekends ago in Des Moines. But the people who were not there, in addition to Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush was not there. Marco Rubio was not there. Rand Paul was not there. But I think the absence of Jeb Bush is more illustrative of what Bush is facing. Because if you talk to the establishment, if you talk to a lot of political journalists and reporters, they say, oh, Jeb Bush is the front runner. He's the guy. He has the money. He has the Bush Rolodex, all those things. But when you heard, and I heard this many times, and I hate please, God, forgive me for saying this, but I'm going to mention the name of Donald Trump. And I don't like to mention the name Donald Trump because I usually like to talk about people who are from this planet. But the point is, at this Iowa summit, Donald Trump stood up and talked about Jeb Bush, about his support for immigration overhaul, about his support for Common Core education standards. And every time Donald Trump mentioned Bush's name, he heard there were large, loud boos throughout the hall. Jeb Bush
Really?
Jeb Bush has a serious problem, and people don't realize this, but it is a serious problem winning over the true believers in the Republican Party, the true Tea Party conservatives. And to his credit, Jeb Bush has said, I'm not going to let ideological litmus tests dissuade me from what I want to do. I mean, we saw the other day that Chris Christie, who is trying to, you know, show his conservative bona fides, said that vaccinations should be voluntary, that parents should have choice, parents should have some choice in deciding whether their children are vaccinated or not. I mean, if that's not the ultimate definition of pandering, I don't know what is. Jeb Bush, to his credit, it will not play the pandering game that Mitt Romney played in 2012, that Christie seems to be playing now. But at the same time, if you want to win the Republican nomination, you have to, you know, adhere to some ideological standards that Bush doesn't seem to be willing to do.
Well, and one more question about the Republicans, and then I do want to ask you about Democrats, especially Hillary Clinton. Been kind of quiet on the Clinton front lately, but on this vaccine issue, this has been big, big news, obviously. And Chris Christie, New Jersey governor, this is from the Washington Post that I'm reading now, walked back from comments he made Monday morning calling for balance on the measles vaccine debate to allow for parental choice. Now he's asserting, quote, there is no question kids should be vaccinated. And then Rand Paul is also sort of walking back from earlier statements. Now Rand Paul is saying, I did not say vaccines cause disorders. I did not allege causation. I support vaccines. I received them myself. I had all my kids vaccinated. In fact, today I received the booster shot for the vaccines I got when I went to Guatemala last year. What is the political point, Ken, of sort of saying one thing on vaccines and then tacking back? Is it a mistake, or is it a deliberate sort of shouting out to two different audiences?
Well, Rand Paul is from the philosophy of the Republican Party that just doesn't believe what the government tells you. And so I'm not saying this is the reason why he has some doubts about vaccinations. And of course, there is some evidence that not every vaccination works, and not every vaccination could be successful. But if the government is pushing vaccinations with this measles outbreak in the West Coast, if the government says you should be vaccinated, Rand Paul and people like that, are their instinct is to say, well, if the government is saying it, it must be wrong. It's one thing for Rand Paul to say that because he's known for having this contrary view about what government is asking.
Sure, he's got that libertarian. Yeah, he has those libertarian. Libertarian leanings. So, but Chris Christie, it's surprising.
Chris Christie, it almost sounded like it was a knee-jerk reaction. Well, you know, the Republican Party stands for choice, and of course, not on abortion, but choice on deciding what to do best for their. For the government shouldn't tell you what to do. It's the parents who should tell you what to do. And I think Chris Christie knows he made a mistake and walked back that position.
Okay, so let's talk about Hillary Clinton. There's been a lot of activity on the Republican side, that big gathering in Iowa, definitely Republican presidential hopefuls coming to New Hampshire. You can hear the crickets chirping on the Democratic side. Ken, what's going on?
It's even more crickets than usual because we expect, there was a lot of talk for the longest time that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party really wants Elizabeth Warren to run. I mean, there's some support for Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Jim Webb, the former senator from Virginia, and perhaps Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland. But there was a lot. There really seemed to be a lot of emotion and passion for Elizabeth Warren a candidacy. A lot of, I don't know what a lot means, but there are some Democrats who feel that Hillary Clinton has been too aggressive on foreign policy. She's too close with Wall Street and the Wall Street, the bankers and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, so there was some kind of indication that if Elizabeth Warren was thinking about it, maybe Hillary Clinton would announce early, like perhaps maybe March or April. Now the word out of the Hillary Clinton camp is that there's no rush, there's no urgency, that she may not even announce her candidacy until July, which makes a lot of people feel that there's not going to be a serious challenge to her nomination at all. Forget about Elizabeth Warren, although in fairness, Elizabeth Warren has said from the beginning she's not running, but
right.
That doesn't mean everybody doesn't want her. But now Hillary Clinton may not announce until July, which kind of makes sense because, you know, I mean, why draw attention to herself when the Republicans are eating their own on that side of the aisle. But it's interesting that it's been so quiet. And here you have, I mean, the thought of a sitting, you have a vice president, and wait, his name is Joe Biden. I had to check, I'm sorry, because I've forgotten. But Joe Biden, I mean, when does a sitting vice president not automatically get the nomination when the president is leaving? Al Gore got it in 2000, Nixon in 1960, Humphrey in 68, I mean, things like that. But Joe Biden seems to be the forgotten man in all this, and it's just kind of fascinating to watch that, you know, that given that he was a loyal vice president, he's done so many things very important to President Obama, the 30 plus years in the Senate from Delaware, and yet he's an afterthought in this whole battle for the nomination.
Well,
and as a matter of fact,
yeah.
I say that in quotes because there really isn't, at least at this point, it doesn't seem to be a battle for the Democratic nomination.
So two quick questions. So and yeah, it's funny, you're leafing through your papers. Who's the vice president? Oh, yeah, Joe Biden. Are you saying that he's been kind of, you know, put on the back burner by the Obama administration, or more just that he really just, you know, he's done, he's happy, he doesn't want to be president?
I think it's neither. First of all, Obama administration has not dissed him at all. He does want to be president. But in fairness to Hillary Clinton, there is history in the making in a potential Hillary Clinton presidency that cannot be denied. It was not denied with Obama in 2008. It's certainly the case in 2012, being the potentially the first female president, and just Biden is just, you know, it's just time. It's just the timing is just wrong. A successful two-term president, he really would love to be president. And a two-term vice president would love to be president, but it's hard to stop this Hillary juggernaut. But of course, in fairness, we said that in 2007 and 2008, not seeing the rise of Barack Obama, you know, at all. But comparing Joe Biden in 2016 to Barack Obama in 2008 is really not fair.
So Hillary Clinton not announcing till July, just kind of keeping a low profile. That just gives her, though, 6 months really to get it up and running before the New Hampshire primary.
Well, her campaign, and she's doing all the right things. She's hiring all the big people. She's raising a ton of money. All her Ready for Hillary groups are really, really active.
Yeah, I've seen some of those bumper stickers.
Just a
yeah.
Really formality. He just really doesn't. She doesn't really have to do anything. Let the Republicans, you know, all the arguments and disagreements within the Republican Party, let that be the focus for the next couple of months.
Maybe that's not such a dumb political strategy. Maybe it makes
no,
sense.
No, not so far. It's working so far.
Okay. Well, we'll see. As you said earlier, last time we had, you know, we thought that this was the Hillary time and it ended up not being the case. So anything can happen in politics. That's why we love sitting down with you, Ken Rudin. Thank you very much for being here.
Laura, it's a lot of fun. Thank you.
We'll see you next month. Ken Rudin, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. Again, he'll be back next month with us here on The Exchange on NHPR. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.